This Week in Retronauts, an indecipherable string of obscenities. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Retronauts. I'm Jeremy Parrish, hosting this episode. And this is another special episode where someone who created a great classic video game is here to tell us about creating a great classic video game. But also with me here to talk about this great classic video game with its creator, we have a Retronauts semi-regular.
Hi, I'm Kevin Bunch. I do the Atari Archive videos, and I really enjoy early game history.
And one of the most, I think, memorable and, for me, when I was like 7 years old, when the game came out, confusing games of all time is Q-Bert. And, as I've gotten older and learned how to control things with a joystick and so forth, it's become more manageable. I understand geometry more as I've aged. It's just one of those games that really sticks out in memory. And it really seems to be having kind of another moment right now. Its creator has recently published a book about its creation, and New Wave Toys is putting out a little miniature Q-Bert replica cabinet that also comes in a variant that's super esoteric. They always do these kind of weird variants that are like, wow, that's a deep cut into history, but this might be their deepest yet. So rather than me tell you all about this, I'm going to hand the mic, the virtual mic, over to our guest of honor this episode. Please introduce yourself.
Hi there. My name. Oh, I feel like the mystery guest.
20 leading questions. Leading up to it.
Call in and guess who this person is. My name's Warren Davis. I designed and programmed the original Q-Bert arcade game. That was followed by about 13, 14 years in the arcade industry. I moved to California, a stint at Disney. Some years in the home game industry, a couple of years with Industrial Light and Magic, and currently doing software consulting for Sony.
So is that in the game side of Sony, or is it more like the business or consumer side?
It's in the game side. Yeah. Okay. I've been doing actually a number of things and working on a number of different projects, but one of the ones I enjoy is trophy engineering, because what they're trying to do is release their old games but add trophies, because the PS4 and the PS5 have a trophy system. And so, you add value to these older games that people remember and love to play by emulating them, but also adding the trophies. And for me, a lot of these games don't have source code or symbols. So basically I call it forensic computing, because I have to basically dig through assembler language code and figure out what the program's doing and where to put hooks in to award trophies. It's pretty fun.
So is that something that Sony has announced, or did you just kind of spill some beans that weren't ready to be spilled yet?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think it was a secret. I didn't think it was a secret. Right. I hope not.
Well, there have been some rumors flying around about their emulation approaches. I know they've also been releasing, there were a bunch of PS2 games on PS4. So I won't press too much for details on what you're working on.
That's exactly what I was working on.
Oh, okay. So nothing top secret at the moment. That's
well,
good.
I can't talk about anything that's about to happen. I can only talk about things that have happened.
Okay, just wanted to make sure that no one gets in trouble here. All right, cool. That's actually interesting. I would love to talk some about the idea of putting hooks and rewards kind of in the modern style into classic games and what that entails. But, first of all, I would like to talk a bit about the book that you have just published or are publishing. It's coming out soon if it's not already out.
Yeah, it is out. And it's a bit of a long story. I won't belabor it, but it started as a memoir that I self-published. I self-published it in 2019. I want to say the end of 2019, just pretty much just before the pandemic. actually, but probably earlier in 2019. It was available during 2019, and then I planned to take it to shows and you know, just sign and sell. But then the pandemic happened. I had to cancel all of my appearances in 2020. And so, you know, I sat around, you know, like most people for that year, doing a lot of nothing. And then I reached out to some publishers to see if anybody was interested. I actually found a publisher that was interested in publishing it, like for reals, as the kids say. So, yeah, it's actually been republished just now. So that whole process took a year. I had to take my self-published version off the market. It was slightly edited. You know, the images were, you know, laid out differently. And, you know, it's just slightly modified, basically the same book, different title, hardcover. It's got a foreword by Ed Boone and an afterword by John Newcomer now. And it's published by Santa Monica Press. So yeah, it's going to be available, much wider release than anything I could have done by self-publishing.
Mm-hmm. So what inspired you to sit down and, you know, write a memoir about creating this one specific game? I mean, it's a much broader ranging book than that, but, you know, the title focuses on Q-Bird, and that is really kind of the meat of the book, I think, that, you know, kind of the most substantial topic in the book.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, you know, time is devoted to Q-Bird, but it covers my entire 14 years in the arcade industry. So it covers, I'd say maybe half the book is about Gottlieb and half the book is about, or a little less than half the book is about Williams, because those were the two major places I worked. I actually did a game called Exterminator for Premier Technologies, and that's a chapter. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff besides Q-Bird in the book. But I think, you know, I'm best known as, I'm best known for Q-Bird. So my publisher certainly thought that the title should reflect that. I actually kept trying to squeeze in some title suggestions that would incorporate more than just Q-Bird. But, I have to agree with the publisher that those were all pretty clunky and didn't really work well. But we compromised by adding the subtitle and other classic video arcade games. So it's in there in the smaller print, but what, to answer your original question, what prompted me, it was stewing in my brain for a number of years. I was going to retro gaming shows and telling stories, and people seemed to be interested in those stories. I'm generally not a person who dwells on the past. So, you know, Q-Bird was in 1982. That's when it was developed. So I had moved on to other things, but people love to hear the stories, not only about Q-Bird, but about Us Versus Them, about the digitizing work I did for Midway. So eventually I started to come to realize there were enough stories to go into a book. And I had to say, I was inspired a little bit by a friend of mine, Josh Gates, who had written a memoir. And I just started to think, oh my God, is it possible? Could I do this? So I think it was around 2017, I actually sat down and started to sort of plan out, how would I structure it? How would I organize it? And it was a two-year process to actually write the book.
Could you talk a little bit about some of the challenges you faced writing this memoir out? Because you're not coming from like a literary background, per se.
You know, it's funny. I actually have done writing throughout my life. I submitted a short fiction story to my high school creative writing magazine that was published. I used to write comedy sketches for radio when I was in college. So I'm not a stranger to writing. I also wrote some technical articles. I co-wrote an article for Dr. Dobbs Journal back in the early 90s. So yeah, I'm not a stranger to writing. So that part didn't daunt me too much. I mean, the idea of writing a whole book was a little daunting, but I actually thought about it like a video game, because, you know, when you start making any project, whether it's a video game or a film, if you're a filmmaker, you know, it's overwhelming. The idea of the finished product, you can't see it in your brain. all you can do is see your next step or maybe a couple of steps ahead, depending on how experienced you are. And so I just said, let me take it one step at a time. So, you know, for me, the first step was an outline. How would I want to organize this? What are the stories I want to tell, you know? And so I spent some time on that. And then it was like, all right, now I've got a chapter list. I mean, just tackle one chapter at a time. That's all I wasn't thinking further ahead than that. So if you break down a massive task down into smaller tasks and just focus on those smaller tasks, and if you give yourself the time and cut yourself some slack, I think you can accomplish pretty much anything. Oh, but well, and also, sorry, I just want to add one more thing. The biggest challenge, apart from the writing of it itself, was remembering things and, you know, not second guessing myself, like doubting my memories, you know. So the other thing I did during those sort of 2 years, when I did go to shows or when I did get together with old colleagues, you know, we talk about stuff and reminisce and I, you know, confirm that I'm not misremembering something. Or sometimes I'd hear stories I didn't remember or know at all. So some of that, you know, filtered its way in as well. But that was the most challenging thing. I wanted to get it right.
Yeah, that was something I really appreciated about the book, is that you were pretty open about, you know, things you did remember clearly and, you know, got backup from your colleagues or, you know, were reminded of by your colleagues. And you were very, very, I think, generous with credit and citing sources and other references, which, you know, a lot of memoirs don't necessarily do. So, you know, I think that speaks well to the authenticity of the book, honestly, and the fact that it's not just your memories, but, you know, kind of your memories pooled together with the conversations with peers and colleagues and, you know, doing your best to paint a bigger picture than just what you remember.
Yeah. Well, and also it's definitely told from my perspective. I mean, mm-hmm. there are things there that, you know, again, I wouldn't think maybe people are even interested in, you know, my particular journey, but I thought, well, I want to make it my personal journey. So it's, you know, I don't tell the history of Mortal Kombat, but I brushed alongside of it and was involved in it to some degree. So that's the part I talk about. And the same thing with, you know, like NBA Jam or other games that I was marginally associated with, but I didn't actually make those games. But that was my approach, and you know, people seem to enjoy it, which I'm very grateful for.
Yeah, one thing I really liked about it was how descriptive you were when you were talking about some of the people that you worked with. Like, you describe Ron Waxman, and I could just sort of picture what that guy must have been like and what it must have been like working with him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and thank God for Ron. He was such a character. He was like a bigger than life character, made it easy. You know, there are other people that were just much, much harder to really dive into because they were a little bit more complex, or maybe even I just didn't get that deep into him. But Ron was a unique guy, as was Howie, his sort of partner in crime in creating the Gottlieb Video Division.
So around the same time that this book is being published, you also have the Qbert cabinet. I guess it's not you specifically, but, you know, New Wave Toys is licensed from whoever holds Gottlieb's intellectual properties at this point. Is it Sony who owns Qbert now? Okay.
Yeah. You know, Gottlieb was owned by Columbia Pictures. Right. Which, you know, it gets a little complicated, but eventually Sony bought Columbia Pictures. So all the rights reverted to Sony.
Okay.
Yeah, I tell the story in the book that I believe I am the person who told Sony that they owned the rights to Qbert back in the 90s. They were not aware of it until I mentioned it.
You gave us the Qbert Renaissance.
It's a story in the book.
Yeah, I work with a game publisher now, Limited Run Games, that does a lot of, you know, reissues of classic games and so forth. And we have a lot of partners based in Japan and here in the U.S. And the big challenge, I think, for us really is just like, hey, we want to do this game. And we know the company we're working with has some rights to it, but do they have all the rights to it? Who has the rest of these rights? Who has the rights to the music? Who has the rights to this version for this platform? Because, you know, like this company can, you know, that we're working with has the rights to the X68000 computer version, but do they have like the Sega Genesis version? Who owns that? You know, it's always this, there's a great deal of sleuthing. So it, having someone who actually knows the specifics is invaluable.
Yeah. Well, thankfully it was somewhat simple. Although I have to say, even within Sony, like, you know, not too long ago, I was inquiring who within Sony actually do you talk to about the rights? And I couldn't get an answer. Some people weren't entirely certain, but anyway, I'm not a lawyer or anything, so I'm sure it's discoverable, but it could be complicated. Luckily Qbert was a simple game, and there wasn't a very long history. I mean, there have been a few Qbert games along the way, but you know, it didn't become a huge mega thing like Pac-Man or mm-hmm. Mortal Kombat. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I was saying New Wave Toys is releasing this mini cabinet. Obviously, you've worked somewhat closely with them on this, because what their variant version is based on not just a like an alternate release of the game, but the cabinet that very specifically you own in your home, which is, you know, that's pretty granular. That's really specific. So yeah. I'm curious what the process there has been. Was that just, you know, like a coincidence that they had just happened to be putting this out at the same time as your book? Or was there some kind of behind the scenes, like, hey, let's, you know, build some synergy here and get these things rolling together?
No, I think the timing is just a coincidence, but it is weird. The whole story of how it came to be is kind of crazy. I still kind of shake my head and wonder about it, but, it all started maybe a couple of years ago. Tony Temple, I don't know if you know him. He goes by the Arcade Blogger, and he has an online blog called The Arcade Blogger. He was in Los Angeles. He's a Brit, but he was in Los Angeles, and I invited him to come over to my house because he was doing an article on sort of like unusual cabinets that are out there. And, you know, my Qbert was an engineering sample. So it wasn't a production version. It was one of the samples that we put out for tests before the game went into production. And then it's a little bit of a Frankenstein job because it has some pre-production artwork on it. And then I've, you know, swapped out the original marquee for the swearing marquee, the infamous swearing marquee where, you know, Howie Rubin wanted it to go out with the swearing balloon as the title of the game. And he just wanted to see it. So he came over and he took pictures and he wrote about it. And I guess New Wave Toys saw this article and they were thinking about, you know, they were doing Qbert and they thought, oh, what should we do for our alternate? And they thought, well, let's reach out to Warren and see if he would be willing to let us do his cabinet. So they contacted me out of the blue. And I was like, really? You know, I said, if you want to do that, sure, but really? So we proceeded and I, you know, I took copious pictures, recreating little stickers that I put on it over the years, recreating the damage from having it be moved from Chicago to Los Angeles. And the one thing that I really was kind of insistent about, because almost as soon as I got this cabinet back in 1983, I replaced the ROMs with faster, harder, more challenging Qbert, which is the version of Qbert that I made right after Qbert that never got released, at least never got released officially by Gottlieb. So for 15 years, from like 1983 to 1998, or 97, maybe, the only place where faster, harder, more challenging Qbert existed was in my cabinet. And then another story, I released those ROMs to the MAME project, and that's when it sort of went public and people can now play faster, harder, more challenging Qbert. But I sort of told the New Wave guys, I'd really like for this version you're making with the Warren Davis cabinet to play faster, harder, more challenging Qbert. If you're emulating the hardware, it's just a ROM swap, and the ROMs are out there on the internet, you know, available. So they went for it, but they said, you know, rather than do like production cabinet with regular Qbert and Warren Davis cabinet with faster, harder, more challenging Qbert, we're going to make it switchable. So both cabinets play both versions. And I thought, ah, that's even better, you know, because it gives people a choice. I know a lot of people are very gun shy about playing faster, harder, more challenging Qbert, especially if they're not that adept at the original.
I was absolutely going to ask if that was going to be included, because I have played that version of it up at the Galloping Ghost in Chicago, and it has absolutely obliterated me, but it's a lot of fun. So I'm glad it's getting out there.
It was you can call that like the director's cut, because, you know, during the development of Qbert, I was constantly asked by people in the office, you know, people, that's how I got most of my feedback at first, is just people in the office playing it, and they'd be like, oh, it's too hard, it's too fast. So you know, I scaled back, and then when it went out on coin testing in arcades and we did some focus groups, you know, management was just very skittish about it being too hard. So I kept scaling it back, and I just felt like it was too easy, but it went out that way. And then as soon as we started getting reports that just some were playing for hours on a single quarter, I just started to freak out. I was like, oh my God, did I make a terrible mistake? And so I started working on faster, harder, more challenging Qbert with Jeff Lee, who of course was my collaborator and the artist for the original version. We both got to working and thinking about what could we do to make the next version, you know, a little harder.
Yeah, I think it's good to have, you know, both versions available, because Qbert itself is, until you kind of wrap your head around how it works and the mechanics, then it's a little daunting. You know, once you get the hang of it, then you can get pretty good at it. But, you know, there's always going to be the arcade savants. You know, I used to work with Jazz Rignall, a British journalist who I think held the record for playing Defender. He played for like 24 hours on a single coin or something, and got to a point where he'd like just fly over to a corner and take a bathroom break because he had so many lives stocked up. But, you know, it's also good to have the kind of like the normal person, you know, the mortal human version available. And that's something I enjoy about New Wave's little mini cabinets, is they've started doing like two ROMs per cabinet, and you can choose which one you get at startup. So I just got their 1942 and 1943 cabinets, which both have, you know, those games are on each of those cabinets, both of those games. But, you know, the 1943 cabinet's great because, one, I played that game so much when I was a kid, and two, they do all these like goofy little details. Like they put like this tiny metal lock on the coin box, and there's actually like a tiny padlock that you can, you know, like shake, and it doesn't actually work because it's 1/6 scale, but still, it's just like all these cool little details and stickers and stuff that you can add to customize it. So yeah, I'm looking forward to, I think right now at the moment they've said Qbert is in a container off the coast of San Diego or LA or something, along with, you know, most of the rest of the world's consumable goods.
At the moment. Yeah. It might be a couple of months away still, but you know, when they were, I guess you would say, courting me, or when they were just asking me if I'd be interested, they sent me a Dragon's Lair just to show the workmanship. And I was just blown away. I mean, their replicates are phenomenal. They're just totally perfectly accurate. And like you said, the details, they put a little plastic non-functional laser disc player in the back.
It's just with it that opens up, and it's got a little laser disc inside of it. Yeah. There's a remote control on it. Yeah. It's
insane.
It's over the top.
And listen, while they were developing the Warren Davis cabinet and the production, the Qbert production cabinet, I mean, I was astonished at the detail. They kept pushing for more and more levels of detail. They wanted to get it absolutely perfectly right. I was just so impressed with them. And I cannot wait to see. I had a prototype for a while that I was playing again to sort of give feedback and compare it against the one I have. But I can't wait to see the final versions.
Yeah, one of the details that kind of stood out to me in your book is about the knocker in the Kubert cabinet, and how you originally wanted it to have a bit of padding so that it didn't just sound like, you know, metal hitting wood. So it had more of like a fleshy sound or something.
Yeah,
I'm curious, is that something you retrofitted into your personal cabinet to kind of, you know, to make it the perfect version, or will the miniature cabinet still have just like the standard knocker?
Well, okay. So first, let me talk about my cabinet. I've been talking about that knocker for, you know, I don't know, 20 years now. And I actually didn't actually do it to my own cabinet until last year. I finally got in there because I was, you know, I don't know, it sounds ridiculous, but I'd be telling people a story about what happened originally and how we couldn't use the little foam to give it more of a thud sound rather than a knock. But it never occurred to me that as people were, you know, buying Kubert cabinets, I mean, because again, it's like a little foreign to me, just the concept that people would own these Kubert arcade cabinets in their homes. But they were not only getting the cabinets, they were, you know, making multi cabinets that played all three Kuberts, Kubert, Faster Heart, More Challenging, and Kubert's Cubes, which I had nothing to do with, but it's a, it is canon, so to speak. It's the third Kubert game from Gottlieb. So, you know, people have these cubes, and it didn't occur to me to tell people, well, you should try it. So I would tell people about it, but I never thought of that until, you know, maybe a few years ago. And then I finally got around to doing it to my own cabinet. And yeah, I like it. I like it better. It's just a slightly muffled sound. So it doesn't sound like a knock. It's definitely a little bit better. Now, as far as the New Wave Toys replicates, their knock just naturally, and I think probably it has something to do with the fact that everything's on such a smaller scale. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't have the weight, and it doesn't, you know, the plunge. I don't know what it is, but it sounds a little more like a softer knock than I think in the original, which to me only works to its advantage. So I was very pleased with the sound of the knock.
I remember the first time, you know, like I said, I was 7 when Kubert came out. I remember the first time I played and died and got that knock, and it terrified me. I just about jumped out of my shoes. I just didn't expect it. You know, I didn't know anything about this game. I jumped off the pyramid like 3 times in a row, probably. And I just remember like the machine basically shaking and making this huge knocking sound. I'm sure it didn't actually shake like I'm remembering it, but you know, everything is bigger in your head when you're 7. So
you hurt Kubert.
Yeah, I felt terrible.
Do you remember a hand coming out and grabbing you by the neck? Yeah,
right. No, it just, you know, it surprised me, but at the same time, that was the kind of really cool sort of, you know, like visceral physical element that arcade games could have at the time that didn't carry over to home versions. So it is one of those things that I think is really sort of a defining trait of the game. And you know, it's just not the same without it. That, and you know, the sampled voice, or I guess it's not sampled, but like the randomized phenoms and things like that.
It's also one of those things that I feel gets lost really easily if you're just looking at the game through emulation, because you don't have that that analog piece of technology there, and the game is lesser for it.
Yeah, there's always, you know, in the arcade industry, we're always looking for ways to make the game, you know, unique and better. We wanted our arcade version to be better than any ports or home games, so that was one way we could do that. And of course, I have to credit Rick Tai was the engineering tech who originally thought of putting a knocker in the cabinet. And I just, you know, the whole process of creating Kubert was an evolutionary one, because it was basically my first game that I was in charge of. So you know, I didn't my ego wasn't big enough to think that I knew everything. So when people suggested things that I thought were cool, I'd say, yeah, cool, let's do it. So that was one example of that. And then, of course, the sound designer, Dave Thiel, came up with Kubert's voice and the random phonemes. And, you know, I consider Dave to be the third member of the team. You know, it was me and Jeff Lee and Dave. I was the filter, because I had to basically code everything. So, you know, if I didn't like an idea, it didn't go in the game. But and it was also my responsibility because that's the way Gottlieb worked. The programmers were the people in charge of the project. But yeah, without the two of them and without the input of other people in the company, it certainly wouldn't be the game it is.
I can't believe I said phenoms instead of phenomes. Yeah, so let me ask you, you know, to like let's turn back the clock a little bit and talk about the actual development of Qubert. I don't want you to, you know, spoil too much of what's in your book, but you know, one thing that does interest me, I think, is how the Gottlieb video game organization evolved out of Gottlieb, the company, which, you know, had a great legacy as a pinball maker, and, you know, kind of what your place was there, not just as a creator, but also as a fan of pinball and as someone who I assume at the time played video games.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm not sure how to answer that. The history of it is pretty straightforward, I think. And of course, I was not there for the origins. I started in January of 82. But Gottlieb actually came out with a couple of video games. I think, you know, the video game industry started taking off in the early 70s, 72 maybe, you know, somewhere around there. You know, there was Pong, there was Space War, Computer Space, there was Tank and Nibbler, and, you know, there was this whole succession of these sort of crude black and white games. And then, of course, you know, the game changer was the 16 colors with, you know, Pac-Man, games like Pac-Man 1981. Anyway, so I think all of the games that were coming out in the 70s were noticed by the pinball companies, and they were like, we need to get on this. This is our industry. This is coin op. These are machines that take coins, and that's what we do. So, you know, most of the pinball manufacturers, Stern, Williams, Bally, they all started video divisions. Gottlieb did not. They were kind of lagging. And I think what they did was just to try to play catch up a little bit in 1977, as they licensed a couple of Japanese games, No Man's Land and New York, New York. And, you know, I don't think there's anything spectacular about those games. And I think they realized that. But I think they also saw, you know, as the industry continued to grow, that they needed to start a video division. And so I'm not sure exactly when it was, 1980, maybe 1981, Ron Waxman and Howie Rubin were tasked with doing exactly that for Gottlieb. And wisely, they picked a location that was about 8 miles away from the pinball plant. And so they had a little bit of autonomy and they could protect us from Gottlieb's management. But when I started working there, the manufacturing plant, which is, you know, a huge, huge area where the assembly line builds the games, was empty. It was deserted. Howie Rubin would come in the middle of the day and say, "All right, everybody stop working. We're going down to the plant. We're going to play some football." And he would force us to stop working and go play football for a little bit. And the reason for that is that their first in-house game wasn't quite ready to go onto the production line. That was Reactor, made by Tim Skelly. So Tim Skelly obviously predated me there. He was hired to sort of be the guru and to make a game and sort of be the mentor to the group. And, you know, he did that. He made Reactor and shared a lot of his knowledge with the rest of us. But yeah, I'm not sure if that answers your question, because like a lot of the parts, again, I wasn't there. Mm-hmm. I know that when I started, they were working on a pinball video game hybrid called Caveman, which actually got released. It was a pinball machine with a video monitor on the play field. And occasionally, if you hit the right shot, you'd switch to a little video game that you'd play. They were also working on the game that I actually started helping out with, which was a superhero game which was called Guardian, Protector. It was called Video Man at one point, and finally Argus, but never got released until recently. You can play it at the Galloping Ghost. Jeff Lee and Doc Mac worked with Tom Malinowski, the original programmer, to actually put one together. So it now exists, even though it was never released, which is pretty cool.
Is also out in to be played in MAME, or have there not been any public ROM releases for that one?
I do not know that. That's something I do not know. It might be available for MAME, but that's up to whether Tom and Jeff released the ROMs to them. I don't know.
I want to say it's on MAME, but I'd have to double check.
It sounds like it should be. I kind of think maybe I heard that it was, but I can't say anything definitively.
So the second part of my question was, just to kind of ask about your own relationship with, Gottlieb's releases, their pinball games, but also video games in general. I know that you had a lot of experience or some experience, before you got into video games with computers and things like that, kind of in the 70s before the microcomputer revolution. But I have to assume that as someone who is making video games, arcade games, you were also out there playing arcade games and, taking notes. And yeah, I'm just really always interested in hearing perspectives from people who were there and who were, a few years older than me, and so had, more clarity into what they were doing, as opposed to, being a kid scared by the Qbert knocker.
Yeah, well, I mean, all through the 70s, I just played games for enjoyment. I just liked playing them. And then when I had the opportunity to start making them, I had no direction, really. I just was like, well, what do I think is fun? And Qbert really didn't even start as the idea for a game. It started as a programming exercise. I was just trying to teach myself how to program randomness and how to program gravity and some real world physics. So the balls bouncing down the pyramid was a way for me to, it was a goal to learn how to do that. But then people were impressed with the way it looked. And so it sort of evolved and it just became a game one step at a time. But, I still continued to play games, and I would play, I would play obviously competitors games, but I don't think I became any more, savvy about it. I still just played for enjoyment, and I would either appreciate what people did, and think, oh, they did something cool. Or I would think, that's just a rip off of what's come before. I always valued sort of innovation. I always valued, and 1982, that was a time where you still could be innovative. The genres hadn't really been well defined, and really was just up to your imagination. So, a lot of games came out that were literally just rehashes of previous games. So I didn't have a high opinion of those, but I did have a high opinion of the people who were, at least, even if unsuccessfully, people who were trying to sort of push the envelope and trying to do something unique. I would admire that, even if the game maybe didn't succeed.
So you didn't necessarily approach competitors' games like trying to dissect them or anything. You were still able to find fun in the games you played.
Yeah. I didn't stop finding fun in video games until much, much later.
Another question I wanted to ask was, obviously you created this game and it became kind of a small cultural phenomenon. You know, there was a cartoon about it and it showed up like character goods. And I think I had like a sticker book with Donkey Kong and Pac-Man stickers and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. There was probably a board game if I'm remembering right. I don't even know.
Yep, there sure was.
How involved were you with this stuff? And what was your perspective on the things that, you know, people kind of took and ran with?
I was not involved at all. I'm Jeff Lee and I were both sort of horrified by the cartoon, the Saturday morning cartoon, because
it did seem to miss the point. Yeah.
Yeah. It was like, wait a minute. He's got arms. He's wearing a high school Letterman jacket. You know, what, you know, people used to say to us, like, what were you smoking when you came up with this game? And I thought, well, what were those guys smoking when they came up with this cartoon? Because it just doesn't seem to have anything to do with anything. But I had absolutely no involvement in any of the licensed products. I was in awe that they existed. I was like, you know, just the thought that something that I had a hand in creating, you know, would spawn all of this stuff was just ridiculous. I just couldn't, you know, it's hard to, you know, file that somewhere where it made sense. But, you know, it was definitely gratifying. You know, it was nice to see that people enjoyed the game. My whole motivation in making video games is to entertain people. It's just, I want people to enjoy it. I want it to be a little break from whatever their stresses are in their life. And it seems like it did that. And so when I saw that, because, you know, I was anonymous, nobody knew who I was. But just to go into an arcade and watch people playing the game was just, you know, phenomenally rewarding for me.
I did want to ask, because in your book, you've talked a little bit about working on a few like kit conversion games. How did that affect the development process working on basically a conversion of an existing title versus something from the ground up?
Well, when you say conversion, I'm not sure what you mean, because
could
have been a completely new game, right? It just needs to go into an existing cabinet. Mm. So you really didn't have too much of a burden of what you had to do. It's just like, so for example, Us Versus Them, okay, was a Laserdisc game, and it was designed to be a kit to go into Mach 3. Mach 3 was a, you know, very successful Laserdisc game that Colleague made, and it had, you know, they had upright cabinets, they had cockpit cabinets because it was a flying game, and so the controller was a joystick, and so, you know, obviously you want to put a game into that cabinet, it's going to be a flying game, right?
Sure.
But other than that, we really didn't have a whole lot of limitations. So, when I was working on Joust 2, which I came into midway, I didn't, midway, get it? Anyway,
I didn't catch that.
But that was unintentional. But when I came into Joust 2, you know, it had already been determined by management. You know, somebody did some sort of marketing study and they'd be like, oh, you know, 90% of the cabinets that are out there are vertical mounted monitors. So we want to do a sequel to Joust, but we want it to be a kit. So to get into as many cabinets as possible, it has to be on a vertical monitor. And I thought that was just a stupid rule to place on a game like Joust, where horizontal distance is the whole point of the game. You know, you're coming at each other horizontally, but it didn't seem to affect the game. The game still seemed to do well, and people to this day still tell me how much they like Joust 2. They think Joust 2 never got enough love.
Yeah, it was interesting to read that the vertical orientation on that game was a management decision and not necessarily an organic decision from the game design, because when I, you know, discovered Joust 2, I think on a Midway collection for PlayStation, I was like, wow, there was a sequel to Joust. I never saw this. That's great. And I booted it up and was like, whoa, why is this vertical? This doesn't make any sense. This doesn't make sense for this game. So
yeah,
now I understand why. So that was illuminating.
Yeah. You have a logical mind. You're able to process information logically, and that's why you thought that.
But yeah, going back to Qbert and you know, the products and stuff, are there any that you feel were like really great interpretations or reinterpretations? Like, is there a Qbert spinoff product that you have a lot of fondness for?
No, I don't have, no, I don't have, it's not, I don't, it's not like I have disdain for them. I just, I always felt like all of the Qbert, you know, games that have come out since the original, well, let's start with Qbert's Cubes. Okay. You know, Gottlieb, of course, asked me to do a true sequel. Like, they didn't want to release Faster, Harder, More Challenging Qbert, even though I said, well, you know, hold on to it for a year and then release it. But they didn't want to do that. Don't know why. That to this day, I will never understand that decision. But they asked if I wanted to do a Qbert sequel. And I wasn't interested. I know that they were floating around ideas for Qbert games that other people might do. But then one of our sort of newer programmers, Neil Bernstein, said to me, is that I've got this idea for a Qbert game. Do you mind if I run with it? And I was like, no, go for it. So that became Qbert's Cubes. And while, you know, it's okay. Again, I don't have any problems with it all. You know, I just kind of felt maybe it was a little esoteric, a little too much brain power needed to, you know, I just thought it was a little complex for an arcade game, but there are people who love it and more power to them because that's the whole idea. It's people who love their games. But the other Qberts that have come out since, I just felt they were, you know, minor rehashes of the original without really bringing anything interesting new to the table. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think Qbert has a problem that a lot of great classic video games have, which is that it's kind of wholly complete in and of itself. You kind of came up with all the variations and permutations on that concept that you could. You've got the pyramid, you've got, you know, gravity affecting the ball, you've got things that totally break gravity and, you know, defy physics and jump along the wrong sides of the cube faces. I don't know, you know, you can jump away from the pyramid to hop on the discs and kind of take a shortcut or you know, evade an enemy. I don't really know that there's too much more you can do with that pyramid. So yeah, I guess then the problem with anyone creating a sequel is how do you do something that's not just more of the same, but still, you know, doesn't fundamentally change the game or, you know, turn it into something else.
Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right. And that's why I think people have been maybe a little too timid in what they've been doing with it and not pushing the envelope of what you can do with that character, with his abilities, with the other characters and their abilities. And, you know, I actually for a while, you know, I wasn't interested in revisiting Qbert for decades. But then people would ask me about it a lot. And then I started thinking about it and I actually thought, yeah, maybe there are some interesting things you can do. So, you know, I have ideas, just have to wait and see if anything will ever happen with them.
Well, the good news is that you do work for the company that owns the rights to Qbert. So
yeah, funny about that.
But it's a big, big company. So I know how processes can take a long time there.
Oh yeah.
Say
oh, yeah.
Sony, give them a call.
Yeah. It's been an interesting journey. Like I said, I did try to reach out couple of years ago and see, you know, who owned the rights, but you know, it's anybody's guess what will happen in the future.
So I did have one last question about Qbert before talking about some of the other projects you've worked on. And that is, of all the, you know, all the versions of the game that were released kind of contemporaneously with the arcade game, you know, home ports and stuff, were there any that you really felt captured the spirit of the game and really did a great job of, you know, bringing home the arcade experience within the limits of the hardware?
Yeah, I think the ColecoVision version was just, you know, head and shoulders above the rest. It I mean, it had the advantage of being newer hardware. So, you know, it was basically designed to do games like Qbert, you know, whereas a lot of the other systems that were older were designed to do games like Pong. So trying to do a Qbert on an Atari 2600 was just, you know, ridiculous. But and then there were some problems with because of the horizontal screen. You know, most TVs were horizontal, Qbert's on a vertical monitor. So some people did weird things graphically, but I thought the ColecoVision was fantastic. I thought they did a great job.
I hate to say that my first experience with Qbert was the 2600 version.
No! And,
you know, I still love the game, so it's the important thing, right?
There you go. Hey, listen, I have nothing but admiration for the programmers who had to make a Qbert on a 2600. My God, what, like, who would want to do that? Who would ever want to do that?
I don't know that they got paid enough.
You look at those, the isometric games that showed up on, you know, arcade games that showed up on 2600, and sometimes you can tell the programmers just kind of said, you know what, we just can't do this. So you have like Zaxxon, which becomes a behind the ship shooter, you know, you're kind of in a first person, third person viewpoint as opposed to the isometric viewpoint.
Right.
That, yeah, it's always like anyone who programmed for the 2600 was a sort of superhero, honestly.
Yeah.
I actually recently did a video retrospective on the Othello Multivision version of Qbert, which is a Japan-only variant on a Sega console that basically was a ColecoVision. It was almost exactly the same hardware. So this version is a little different than the ColecoVision version, but it's actually the only good game for the Multivision. It had 8 games, I think. Well, 9 if you count the built-in Othello that came with it. And they're all pretty bad, except Konami apparently programmed Qbert for Multivision, and it turned out really well. It's a really solid conversion.
Interesting. I've never seen it. I've never seen that or heard of it.
It's out there and costs hundreds of dollars if you want to experience it for yourself, because that's what old video games cost these days. It's terrible.
No, I'd rather get a New Wave replicate.
That's probably the way to go. I think that's going to have HDMI out too, so then you can play it on a TV. And
yes, nice. they not only they have the HDMI out, but they also have USB in. So if you have an external control panel or joystick, or even like a DualShock, I think will work. You know, you could basically just use the arcade cabinet as a CPU, mm-hmm. and play it with a big screen and with a modern controller, which to me, again, fantastic, amazingly engineered product.
Making me want to get a 4-way limiter for a joystick.
I was
going to
say, that's the one missing piece there, really. You know, going beyond Qbert, you've worked on, I think, some pretty esoteric games, but also some very well-known games. You know, of those, which do you think tended to be the most satisfying? I think, you know, based on kind of what you said in the book, there were a lot of other factors beyond just the games themselves that affected your experience there. But, you know, just, you know, going beyond Qbert, going beyond Gottlieb even, what was that like, honestly?
You know,
kind of a big question.
It's a big question. Well, everything, making a game is obviously a very different experience from playing a game. And, you know, a game may turn out to be like some classic, but it's very possible that the making of it was fraught with difficulty and frustration. And I don't think I ever had a situation where, you know, I was, I don't know, having a nervous breakdown or something. I think I came close on the one Spyro the Dragon game I worked on in early 2000s, but that's a story for another day. But most of, you know, the arcade experiences I had, you know, there might've been little frustrations here and there, but, you know, generally I just was always happy to be having the opportunity to do what I was doing. You know, I believed that it was a privilege to be able to do what I was doing. So I was happy to be able to do it. But things like Us Versus Them, which was a Laserdisc game, there were a lot of pressures. We were shooting flying footage. I was up in helicopters and Learjets, trying to, you know, instruct people, producers, and how to get the footage we needed. And I did all the editing for it. I was directing the actors when we were shooting the live action scenes, and I was coding the game. So, you know, I was doing a lot, as was the rest of the team, because, you know, I wasn't the only one on the team, but we were trying to make a show. And I was pulling all nighters for days and days trying to get something ready for a show. And it was, you know, management at the very last minute said, we're not going to show it. And I was really, really crushed because I had been busting my ass and I believed I would have it ready, but they didn't want to take the chance. So they pulled it at the very last minute and the game got finished. And then of course the frustration was that the Laserdisc industry crashed. So there was a lot of disappointments there, but again, proud of how the game turned out. I couldn't have been more pleased. I to this day, it might be the game I'm the most proud of. And then things like, I mean, Terminator 2 was a pretty smooth ride for me, as was, I think, Revolution X. You know, the only, you know, Revolution X maybe, yeah, I mean, I can't really remember anything horrible. There is a story, though, about after Revolution X, I started working on what would have been a Highlander game. And that was frustrating in that we were waiting for a deal with the people who owned the rights, the TV rights to Highlander, because we were basing this on the TV show at the time. And I was kind of excited about it, but not only were we getting stalled in negotiations with the people who had the rights, we were also getting flack from management. This is the company that put out, Mortal Kombat and Terminator 2 and
Narc.
And Total Carnage, and they're telling me for Highlander, do you have to cut somebody's head off? We're a little worried about the violence. So
we're worried.
Yeah. So and I understand where that was coming from. The tides were shifting. They were getting a lot of flack about Mortal Kombat. Even again, I write in the book the story about Terminator 2. You know, Entertainment Tonight did this hard-hitting piece on Terminator 2, the violence in Terminator 2. But so I think they were getting a little skittish, but it was very surprising to me and frustrating. But ultimately, that game never got made, and I moved to California. I actually left Chicago.
Yeah, that would have had the poor timing to coincide with, you know, the congressional hearings and Senator Lieberman, you know, coming down on video game violence and Tipper Gore. I can't remember who else was involved, you know, Howard Lincoln standing in front of Congress and throwing Sega under the bus, that kind of thing. So, yeah, rough times, which, you know, it only seemed to really have an impact for a few years, like 2 or 3 years. And then, you know, this PlayStation rolled around and you were getting games that were generally pretty violent, had more sexuality in them as I think, you know, the market aged, you know, the audience aged and people said, okay, you know, it's not just 12-year-olds playing this. It's also 21-year-olds and adults and so forth. But right. Yeah, it does seem like it would be frustrating to kind of have to roll with the tides of pop culture and you know, just kind of the shifting winds of politics when you're just trying to make a video game.
Yeah. Well, I actually, you know, am aware that, you know, video games don't exist in a vacuum, that, you know, people play them, that young children might be exposed to them. So, you know, that was always a concern of mine. It was never my dream or goal to make something that was, you know, graphically repulsive. And even with the Highlander game, it wasn't intended. There wasn't going to be spurting blood and stuff like that. It was going to be a bloodless beheading, if you will.
But a nice clean cut.
But, you know, again, it's, you know, how do you do Highlander without beheading somebody? That's the point of the whole story. I just found that interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even Qbert didn't actually swear. He just had little cartoon balloons with symbols in it. So,
yeah. Yeah. He never actually swears unless, you know, the random phonemes come out in the right order, which is possible, but it's, you know, pretty unlikely.
Yeah. Extremely slim odds. Yeah, I'm curious about Us Versus Them. You said that's the game you're probably proudest of. Has that ever been made available in any other format besides the original arcade? Was it put on like Laser Active or anything like that? Or is it just...
I don't know about Laser Active. I think it's available on MAME, actually, I think. I know that there's been a board out called the Dexter, I believe, which replaces the Pioneer LaserDisc player. So if you have the movie part of it on a thumb drive, you can play any LaserDisc game without having to worry about it skipping. Much more reliable in an arcade cabinet. So I know that there a lot of Us Versus Them arcade cabinets have been restored, or you're seeing a lot more of them that are playable. There's also a PC version. There was a project called Daphne, which there was a LaserDisc emulator, I guess. And so Us Versus Them is available to play on a PC, which is pretty cool. Of course, you know, I think you really need that flight stick to get the feel, you know, but you could play with a joystick. Other than that, I'm not sure that it's been made available any other places. Maybe New Wave Toys will make a replica version someday.
There you go. Mach 3 and Us Versus Them.
You know what? That'd be, oh my God, that would be awesome. Do a dual Mach 3 and Us Versus Them. You hear me, Shiloh? Do it.
I did think it was really interesting that you went from this LaserDisc project that was very sort of a film-oriented thing into digitization of graphics in several of your future game projects. I thought that was an interesting move. Was there any sort of direct linkage there, or did it just sort of happen that way?
Well, you know, I think the linkage is that I always was interested in filmmaking. I was making films in high school, and you know, I thought of actually studying filmmaking as a career choice when I was ready to graduate. But you know, to me it was 50-50 whether I went to computers or filmmaking. And you know, most of the adults in my life steered me to computers, but I didn't mind. I was very happy, and so that's what I did. But I always had an interest in filmmaking. And doing Us Versus Them, for me, really satisfied that itch in a lot of ways. But more than that, I think everybody working in the industry, you know, we started with black and white, little blocky pixels, you know, or blocky images in video games. Then we went to cartoony graphics with 16 colors. And I think we all knew, everybody knew, that as memory became cheaper and more dense, that, you know, we were going to have more memory, faster CPUs, and we knew that we were moving towards photorealistic graphics. We didn't know when we'd get there. We didn't know how we'd get there, but I think everybody knew we'd get there. So exploring digitized graphics when I started, which was probably like 1986 on the Amiga, that was just a step towards, you know, where I knew the future was going. So I just didn't know how to get there. And really it was the Targa boards, the release of the True Vision Targa boards that had digitizing capabilities that I was able to write my own software to control that board to do what we needed to get digitized graphics into our new 256 color hardware system. Like, oh my God, 256 colors. How could you ever need more than that? No, we knew that still wasn't enough for photorealistic, but you know, we started working on that. And I personally, you know, sort of made it my mission to try to bring photorealistic graphics to our arcade hardware.
Have you had the opportunity to do more film-oriented type work beyond Us Versus Them? Is that something you've ever had an itch that you wanted to scratch again?
Yeah, I do it occasionally. I ever since digital filmmaking started, mm-hmm. like digital cameras, I was like, okay, now I'm all over that. I was never a fan of, I was always a photographer, but I was never a fan of chemicals and, you know, and shooting on film and then waiting to see if you got your light right. And then you didn't, and then you had to go redo everything. Digital with instantaneous feedback was, you know, a dream for me. So as soon as digital photography was invented, I got back into filmmaking, and I also am sort of tapped into the acting world. I've been an actor for years, and I know a lot of actors. So, you know, I'll write scripts, and I'll make short films, you know, when the fancy strikes me. But I've made a number over the years.
Yeah, I was going to say the move to digital photography and the fact that filming is no longer based on film and is much more economical. It's, you know, less expensive. It's more immediate. You get that quick reaction, you know, quick turnaround on being able to look at, you know, you don't have to wait for rushes, basically. That's caused a little bit of a revival of, you know, FMV type games along the lines of Us versus Them. And there's a company based in Wales called Wales Interactive that has really, really gotten into that in the past 5 or 6 years and has put together some games that really, you know, take the interactive movie concept of the 90s and the 80s and really taking it in interesting new directions. There's actually, surprisingly enough, you know, this format that kind of seemed to go the way of the dinosaur 30 years ago has come back and is there's a lot of innovation happening in it now.
That's awesome. I wasn't aware. I'd love to see some of that stuff. I think, you know, full motion video kind of went the way of the dinosaur because 3D graphics became the cool thing. So it was all about polygons and textures, and the industry embraced that so wholeheartedly that you couldn't really do anything else. And, you know, for a while, I think, you know, the results paid off. I certainly think you can do so much. I mean, look at the graphics of games today. It just blows my mind how realistic they are, and it's fantastic. But I think what gets lost in these beautiful looking games is, you know, the gameplay. It's still about gameplay, and if people forget that, personally, I think the industry suffers. You've also got the problem, which I've seen in a lot of really high end titles. Is they're not that interactive, you know. You spend most of your time watching cutscenes, and to me, that's not why I sit down and play a video game. I don't want to see 2 minutes of a movie and then get a little control for a little bit until the next movie that I have to watch. I want to literally be interactive. The problem with FMV, of course, is that for a true interactive movie, if you really want to have branching, it explodes so much. You need so much storage for all the places your story can go. And you have to generate all that content, which the player may never see. And I understand that that's a little bit of a concern. We did that a little bit with Us versus Them. That was, you know, there are actually branches that will take you to different locations. So every time you play that game, you may not see the same, you may be flying over a different city than the last time you played. But, you know, we had to be smart about it and structure it in such a way that, you know, we could still fit what we wanted to on the laser disc. Nowadays, storage is not really a problem, but I think generating all the content you'd need might be.
Yeah, just a different problem with the, yeah, as you said, I don't know where I was going with that. I lost my train of thought.
Listen, I just, you know, it's all, the future is always exciting. Like, I love VR. I think VR is something that I thought about back in the 80s and 90s. We had 3D glasses, you know, 3D movies, of course, big in the 50s. And then they had a little bit of a resurgence in the 70s. But, you know, I think the technology even for that wasn't quite right. People would get headaches and they really didn't know about convergence points and things like that. But, you know, I love 3D in movies and I love the idea of VR. And I hope that sticks around this time because I just think the potential for it is amazing. You know, the potential for immersive entertainment and AR. I think AR has also got amazing potential. Augmented reality where, you know, you've got computer-generated imagery in the real world that you see in the real world. But I haven't seen much done with it lately. I'd love to see where that's at.
So are you thinking Qbert VR?
Why not?
How would that work? It seems like it'd be really difficult because you'd be looking down the whole time, you know, at your feet to see. That's always the big problem in VR. Do you have feet? Like, this is a game where you're always looking down because you've got the pyramid beneath you.
Yeah,
well, you're gonna watch out for a wrong way to just flying across your vision.
Yeah, no question. There are issues that that need to be worked out, but that's what you do. You work them out. Mm-hmm.
All right, Warren, any final nuggets of wisdom you want to share with us before we wrap this podcast?
I'd love to let people know where they could get my book. And the answer to that is, well, if you want there's a regular old non-autographed version, you can get one at any place finer books are sold, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or your favorite independent bookstore. If they have a website, you can order it there and support them. I'd also mention, if you want an autographed copy, I have those available at my website, which is warrendavisshop.square.site, S-I-T-E. And you can order an autographed copy. And if you want to personalize, you could say how you want to personalize. So, and then I also want to mention, if anybody's interested in this stuff, because people seem to be, then I highly recommend a documentary by a guy named Josh Tsui called Insert Coin. I don't know if you've heard of it or seen it. A fantastic documentary about Williams Valley Midway and basically the from NARC to the mid-90s, I guess. Really well done documentary. And then also Jeff Lee has his own book, which I think is available on his website, which I'm not sure what the site is, but his book is more of a history of Gottlieb. Mine is sort of my own personal journey through all the places I've worked, but his is kind of about all the people and games of Gottlieb, and it's called Qbert and We. That's about it.
Do you have a social media presence, like, you know, Twitter, Facebook? Do you make videos on YouTube or TikTok or whatever?
I do not make videos generally for TikTok or YouTube.
It's blowing up. I don't know. Everyone seems to be doing it.
Maybe someday. I do have I have Twitter. If people want to connect with me on Twitter, it's at WarrenDavis29. And on Facebook, I have a personal page, which a lot of times people reach out to me on my personal page, but that's really just for my close friends and family. I do have a public page, though, so please feel free to go to facebook.com/WarrenDavis29, and you can reach me there.
All right. And so I guess we'll wrap here. Kevin, where can people find you on the internet?
I'm on Twitter at Ubersaurus, and I'm on YouTube under the channel name Atari Archive.
And finally, if you are listening to this podcast for the first time or just forgot since the last time we did this spiel, you can find Retronauts online many places where podcasts are found. And you can support us directly by subscribing to the show at Patreon, patreon.com/retronauts. Subscribe for $3 a month, and you get every episode a week early at a high bitrate quality, which sounds better. And if you do $5 a month, you also get 2 exclusive podcasts each month, plus Discord access, plus weekly columns and mini podcasts by Diamond Fight. So that's a lot of stuff for an extra $2. Check it out at patreon.com/retronauts. And of course, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, online many places, such as YouTube as Jeremy Parrish, and Limited Run Games, and on Twitter as GameSpite. So yeah, that's about it. So, Warren, thanks again for your time and sharing your thoughts and recollections and just perspectives on creating a classic game and beyond.
My pleasure, guys. Thank you for having me. And thank you for everything you do to keep the stories alive and to keep the memories alive and to just celebrate these great old games. I appreciate that.
We can't help it. We just love video games. And we love talking to the people who made them. So thanks for being on the show. And everyone, definitely be sure to check out Warren's book and learn a little bit about the history of video games, another facet that has not been explored in print before. That's it for this episode of Retronauts. Thanks again, everyone, and especially to Warren. And with that, I think we jump off the pyramid and the knocker hits the door.
Bye-bye.
Bye.